Hello, everybody. I'm Howie Hawkins. I was the Green Party and the Socialist Party candidate for president in 2020. And this podcast, Green Socialist Notes, is about continuing to organize and educate around the eco-socialist program that that we ran on in 2020. Before we get to our guests, I just want to give a brief report on this tour of the Ukrainian and Russian anti-war socialists. We just had two great events in Chicago, and tonight they're going to be in New York City speaking at 7 Eastern time. And we'll put in the chat a link to where you can register for a live stream about it. And we'll also put in the chat three interviews they did. They came out Thursday, one with The Nation, one with Democracy Now!, and one with the Troy, New York Independent Media. So I hope people can take that in tonight. And so far so good. That tour has been really good. So today we have back with us Natalie Monarez and Bill Berry to talk about what's going on at Amazon, particularly worker safety and health issues, which is a real problem. And Natalie, you've had some recent experiences there at the Staten Island Hub. Why don't you fill us in on what's going on there? We can't hear you. You're muted. We heard you a few minutes ago. Can you still hear us? Sounds like she can, or looks like she can. While we're waiting for Natalie to figure that out, we also have something for the chat. It was an article in Labor Notes on Thursday about countering dangerous work at Amazon. And it talked about some other hubs where workers are not getting fair treatment for dealing with workplace injuries and illness. And some of the workers at these hubs have filed with the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, which I think Natalie's been contemplating at the Staten Island Hub as well. So if we can get that in the chat, that'll be good background to this whole topic. Well, Bill, you want to say a few words about this while Natalie tries to fix her audio?
Yeah. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
All right. Well, I think Natalie's issue is that she is at an incredibly intense location and without a union. And what got this whole topic started over the last two or three weeks is Natalie sent me some discussions about the conditions there and two parts of the conditions. One of them were just the conditions of general safety and health, part of them during the fires, part of them during the incredible heat. Obviously, the intense work of Amazon. But a second part, which is a hidden health and safety issue, is co-worker violence. And she was attacked by one of her co-workers. And what we've seen in the past several years, certainly during COVID, as pressure has ratcheted up both on the job and off, is that people will often bring emotional problems into the job. And they spill over. And for many years as a union rep, we tried to do this in a preventive way. That is, if you saw people who would say things or kind of making remarks, and it's certainly increased now where people can put stuff on social media because you just can't have that kind of activity. And the challenge for a union person, a union officer, or rep, steward, is that you don't want to see one of your coworkers fired. You don't want to have to take up a discharge case. But you also want everybody to be safe in the workplace. So being proactive and starting a workplace safety and health program run by the union, you can't depend on the federal government to come in and save you. We certainly saw it during the Trump administration when basically OSHA was almost closed. And there was almost no inspections, and particularly during the time of COVID. But just as a general policy, the union needs to control the workplace and not depend on the federal government. One of the biggest issues that you'll see in the books and stuff like that that I do on getting a first contractor, people keep saying, well, the labor board's going to come in and issue a complaint. Well, that's not going to get you a contract anymore. It's going to make you safe. And what Natalie found and will describe if she can get her technology going is how they even had the police in her facility. And her plant manager ran out the back door so he wouldn't have to talk to them. They wouldn't provide videos of the workplace assault. And so it's a regular and ongoing challenge to people who work there. Obviously, it's intensified by the fact that they are still non-union, that they've only started the beginning to put in a union within the workplace. And they don't have a contract. There are all kinds of other issues going on with the people who are active in the union. But it's a very, very challenging situation that we all find. And as people come back to work in person, they bring a lot of tension with them. And, you know, it's the weather, it's the fires, it's the pressure by these companies to make as much money as they can. Many cases, the healthcare industry, the hospitality industry, incredibly understaffed, postal system. And so that the pressure of people is terrible. There was a story here in Baltimore about a security guard who is being charged with shooting an alleged shoplifter. We're not quite sure what happened, but it turns out she was working a second 12-hour shift. And it's just, you can't do that. You're going to lose it. We're certainly seeing it in the public schools already as they start. And they're way short. Baltimore City is like 600 or 700 teachers short. And so this kind of pressure that people bring into the workplace and that the workplace creates is a very dangerous situation. And we've got to move quickly and proactively. We can't wait for somebody to get hurt. We got to move and make conditions better before they do. So I don't know, Natalie, you having any luck getting your sound going here on? Because her stories are extraordinary. And I got to say that this woman is a fighter 1,000 times multiplied and is incredible courage, incredible determination, incredible smarts. And I've never met her in person. I've got contacted with her online to help out the local kind of get started several years ago. And it's just amazing what tenacity and intelligence she has.
Yeah, well, we had Natalie on before and she talked about, you know, the union organizing, problems within the union, how they were trying to deal with that. And people should understand that she's still living out of her car, showering at Planet Fitness, working full time, which means the wages in particularly New York City area can't pay for a worker to have an apartment. And that's just part of the conditions we're under. I mean, even with the union, I think you made a good point that we can't rely on the government. You know, at UPS where I worked, you know, we had all kind of OSHA violations every day, all the time. People getting concussions, rupturing discs, carpal tunnel, broken bones, strains, sprains, ligament tears. And then when OSHA came to inspect, we knew about it ahead of time. And the management would say, okay, work everything properly. And we slowed down to about half pace because we were actually working correctly. And then OSHA would come in and everything looked okay. They'd leave and we'd go back to where we were before and people would be getting hurt. So, you know, that's just one problem. OSHA is understaffed and the inspections are infrequent. And when they do come in, they're not consequences for the company in most cases.
Can you hear me?
Natalie, can you hear us?
Can you hear me, Howie?
Yes, I can.
Oh, because somehow I had a thing that went mute. You're muted, you're unmuted. It's all this technology. I think starting in the 1930s, if you look at labor history, unions and particular officers started depending on the government to come in and solve their problems. And, you know, the 30s was a period of incredible organizing within the workplaces, of sit-down strikes, the general strikes, things like that. And in order to kind of control us, they put in the National Labor Relations Act. And so today, and as I said, I've got this book on getting your first contract, officers will say, well, we'll file an unfair labor practice about refusal to bargain. Well, there is no requirement in the law that the company reach an agreement with you on a contract. And bargaining means simply sitting at the table, yawning and smoking or doing whatever they do, and then going home. And so we have to go back as unions to self-reliance, to look at our own strength in the workplace, our own strength in the community, building relationships like that. And certainly the unions like the school teachers, the teachers' unions have started to do that. And globally, and other unions in the country. I mean, I can tell you maybe on one hand or so, the number of Labor Day parades. There was not one in Baltimore as a major city, nothing. And we used to have them here 10 years ago. When I was working, and they stopped. And so it's up to us. We've got to organize. If we're 5% of the workforce, we've got to go to be back where we were at 40% from the late 1950s, and then things will be different. But every day, people like Natalie risk their health, their safety, their lives, unfortunately, by going to work. And this was intensified during COVID, certainly in the healthcare industry. Where people and industry like meatpacking, where companies would not provide masks. And unfortunately, the officers of the union sat back and said, well, we want the company to do this. Instead of saying, no, we'll come in. The union will come in and do it. We'll test people. We'll provide protective equipment. And we're not going to work if it's not safe. So it's a whole change in attitude that we've got to go through. So this is very frustrating that Natalie can't get on. I don't know what's... what's going on? I keep seeing that thing spinning there. She was on once, and I don't know.
Well, I can see her.
I can see her.
Yeah, but we can't hear her. Natalie, can you hear us? Yeah, she can hear us, but... she can't get her voice on. Mm. Maybe Chris could call her and they might see what could be done. Yeah, I just watched the UPS, you know, practice a strike but not conduct one. And I was getting calls from groups like Democratic Socialists of America, you know, to explain to them you know, how to support the strike. And, you know, I didn't think a strike was coming because it was pretty clear to me that the company had conceded on a few of the workplace working conditions demands. And all that was left was particularly wages for the part-timers, which are very low.
Yeah.
And the company had lots of money. So they held back a little bit, and then they came forward, made an offer, and the union accepted it and didn't go on strike, even though they originally said if the contract wasn't in place by the end of the last contract, they would. So they didn't. And what that did, I think, was strengthen the hand of the top leaders saying, look, we got you a decent contract. The part-timers went for it. It was a $5 immediate wage increase for the starting wage, although they only increased by $2 more over the next 5 years.
Yeah.
And so if they had gone on strike, it would have, I think, given the rank and file a sense of their strength and built ties and organization and camaraderie.
Oh, that's right. And I think also a 5-year contract is way too long. It's a bad idea. But I also think, you know, as we're just talking, waiting for Natalie, that people look at you either take a lousy contract or you go on strike. And I think what you have to look at are how can you pressure the boss? Because we've seen cases. There was a United Mine Workers strike down in Alabama. They were out for a year and came back without a contract. I mean, look at the writers, the movie writers, and actors, screen actors now who've been on strike 3 months. And, you know, they obviously should have negotiated together from the beginning and would have helped it out. But you've got to figure out where can you pressure your employer. Leverage is what I call it. And leverage is to make the company do, the boss do what he doesn't want to do. And we've talked to some people, for example, at Starbucks, and they're in the same situation that Natalie is in. More spread out, much smaller workplaces, easily closed, unfortunately, by Howard Schultz. But look at everything that comes into a Starbucks store, from the coffee to the glasses to the toilet paper to uniforms to everything. Where could you stop something? Where could you hold something up so that you'd be getting paid, but you'd be doing what you didn't want to do, and how it was exactly what you talked about when you were working at UPS, that you slow down, you work to rule, you work safely, and you work at like half the speed. And companies are going to respond to that very quickly, and they're going to do what you want to do or not. And I'm concerned that this kind of macho talk about, you show them you're going straight. That's great if you're a place like UPS where you could really shut them down. But we're seeing in the screen actors and in the writers that you're not. You know, they've got product to put out there and they're willing to wait. And so you're in strike for 2 months or 3 months. And it's a lot to ask of people. So I think.
Yeah, one thing I noticed over, you know, the 2 decades I was at UPS is I came in and it's my generation, a lot of Vietnam veterans, they didn't take too much from the bosses. You know, if the supervisors were acting out or something was unsafe, people would stop work and say, you got to fix this or, you know, and we got responses. And as those guys, you know, phased out, retired, the younger guys just didn't have that experience. You know, they came in there and the way UPS sets up the 2 tiers, you know, 80% of the workers are part-time and 20% full-time, which creates a division right there. And the part-timers, for the most part, they just see it as short-term. They're not going to stay 5 years to get vested in the pension. They like the health care, which is very good, but if they can get another job that pays more, they're gonna go to it. Yeah. And the company likes that because then people don't get to know each other and, you know, be able to build relationships so they can organize. And so one of the things, they got rid of the 2 tiers within the drivers, but they didn't get rid of the 2 tiers for the same work between part-timers and full-timers, which has been around since 1982 and is a real problem. and something I wish, you know, the Teamsters would take on. Now they got to wait 5 years, like you pointed out. Yeah.
Well, I think just look at a company like Amazon. Bezos likes to have 150% turnover every year. And the kind of things that you talked about, Howie, are exactly that. People figure, well, I'll work here for a while, or I'll work here during holiday season, or I'll do this. And they actually used to offer bonuses in January for people to quit, you know, because they want to build up their employment during the holiday season and then have people leave. And I think it's a very, very dangerous, it's a very challenging when you're trying to do what Natalie's doing, is building a union, because you have enormous turnover. I had a guy here as a guest speaker. I did a labor history class. He's totally different industry. He's a graduate student at Johns Hopkins University. There are 3,300 of them organized by the United Electrical Workers in a negotiation, but they have a 10% turnover every year. And so that means you have 300 new people coming in who knew nothing about the original campaign, nothing about anything. And the union officers and members need to set up a program to educate these people. And it's a huge challenge at a place like Amazon, where you have an enormous workforce, frantic time. You're not affiliated with the union, so you don't necessarily have the resources to do it. And I also think, Howie, what you talked about is the people who came to work during the 70s and 80s often were from a generation whose parents were in the union and they'd heard about it. And that is gone. And so most people come into the workplace today without any knowledge of a union. And it's a kind of a thing where, as an internal organizing gesture, your new hires, and often what unions will do is their stewards and officers will think they're successful if they get someone to sign a dues checkoff form. And they figure, well, they're a union member. Well, they're not. They're just a dues payer. And you need to really create a program that will bring them into a knowledge of what the union is. You need to have a website with history of how we got this benefit, exactly the kind of stuff you're talking about here, Howie, going back 25 years. And often young people will figure, I don't give a shit what happened yesterday. But knowing how we got to where we are, for better or for worse, is really, really important. So, Natalie, no luck getting Natalie.
Okay, can you hear me now?
We can hear you.
We can hear you.
Testing 1, 2, 3.
We can hear you.
Uh-huh. They can hear you, Natalie.
I can see her now.
I'm sorry, what did you say?
We can see you and we can hear you.
Testing 1, 2, 3.
They yep. can see and hear you.
Can turn her up just a little bit, the volume.
I can't see them on the screen. They disappeared.
Can you hear us?
Is it possible for me just to be a phone guest?
Yeah, if you can hear us. Why don't you just start telling us about what's going on at the Staten Island Hub? I think she can't hear us. She can, we can hear her and see her.
You know, maybe we ought to try this again another day, Howie, and make sure she gets to a place where she can get on and we can hear, because the program is about her. It's not about me. No, Natalie, we can't hear you.
Well, we can do that, and I'd like to, but hopefully we can, in the last 20 minutes we have, or maybe 30 because we started late, we can figure out how to get her on. Yeah, I think the generation gap of people that don't have experience with unions is really hurting us. Yeah. The irony is, according to public opinion polls, more people are favorable toward unions than they've been in generations. It's just they don't know how to organize them or use them when they got them.
That's right. Well, I'm doing a new revising my organizing book, and I'm saying, well, if 71% of the population is positive about unions, then our membership should be 71% of the workforce. And the officers who will go around and say, see, this is really great. We're doing great. And the private sector is 5%. We are where we were in 1900. You know, you just can't, and you can see it. The one statistic is that, like in the late 50s, 37% of the population was in the workforce. Somebody estimated that another 40% got the union conditions. That is, we set the conditions because we were 37% of the workforce. Today, Warren Buffett sets the conditions. Sam Walton sets the conditions because we are 5% in the private sector. And you could see it coming in the 80s when I was negotiating contracts. All of a sudden, that the stuff you talked about, Howie, the two-tiered wage system, health insurance copay. At one time, it was assumed that the employer would fully pay for the health insurance and for the family. And that's gone. You would assume that you would have a pension. That's gone. You have 401ks and IRAs and all kinds of stuff, but the company doesn't have to put any committed money into it. And we've just seen this enormous shift. And we've lost our political push. For example, there's no strength for getting a national health insurance. You know, and Howie, when you campaigned for president, it was certainly one of your big issues. And it's something we so desperately need. And you can see the challenges that people have today just getting health care. So,
and another thing that's so popular with the public, you know, the problem is public opinion doesn't translate into public policy.
No, money translates for the existing parties.
Yeah. You know, indication of how bad it's got. When I first tried to get into UPS in the early 70s, the starting wage was $10 an hour. Which today is $72 an hour in real terms.
Yeah, no, that's right.
The top wage after this contract for the drivers is $49 an hour. And after a $5 raise, the starting wage is $21 an hour at UPS. So back in the early 70s, I didn't get in. It was a really good job back then. I could live on that part-time, you know, unloading trucks.
Yeah.
And, you know, when I got, so then what happened in 82, concessionary contract, they introduced the two tiers. They shifted a lot of work from full-time to part-time. They sped up the part-time because they'd wear people out in 3 or 4 hours at a pace they couldn't last for 8 hours.
Yep.
And that was part of the business plan. And that two-tier system still exists. In 1997, when UPS did go on strike and won the best contract they've won until this one, they got the starting wage raised from $8 to $8.50. So when I finally got into UPS in 2000, the starting wage was $8.50. And in real terms, you know, I don't know what it was exactly then, but it was a fraction of what I would have got when I started in the 70s.
Yeah.
So, you know, working people are, you know, they're working hard, but they're getting less in real terms than we were getting, you know, 50 years ago.
Even well, though if you look,
it's more productive.
Look at the minimum wage. I mean, if the minimum wage today were what it was in the 70s, it would be $28 an hour. And people talk about, well, fight for 15. Well, it's just, and accepting these losses, and it's, many of us are privileged. I'm retired. I've got a house. I'm okay. But people day to day, extraordinary pressures. Natalie is a perfect example of that. Can't afford to have a place to live in New York City. Constantly harassed in the workplace. It's just terrible.
Yeah, the minimum wage is $7.25. Hasn't gone up in I don't know how long. And the tip wage is $2.80.
Yeah, that's horrible.
I made a stop on my campaign in Southeast Tennessee at 2 a.m. at a Waffle House. And the waitress, we gave her we asked her, what she thought about the election. And she said, "Oh, I don't vote. They don't care about me." And we gave her a palm card with our stuff. And she came back and said, "I could vote for this." But it turns out she was working $2.80 plus tips, working overnight at Waffle House where there wasn't many customers. Yep. She wasn't even making $7.25 an hour, although the company's supposed to top it up to that if she doesn't get the tips, but she wasn't. It's incredible that people can work at those wages and still somehow survive.
I'm not sure they do. And what we would call survival. So,
hey, Natalie, can you talk and see if anyone can hear you?
Hey, Chris, I just sent you a picture of what I see on email.
Okay.
We can hear Natalie. Can she hear us?
I can hear you.
Well, then why don't you take a few minutes and just talk about what's been going on at the Staten Island Hub for safety and health issues.
Okay. It actually got really bad in July when Prime Week happened. It was in the middle of a heat wave, and of course it was extremely hot inside the warehouse, and being mandatory overtime the entire week. We did have one of our veteran workers start feeling sick and went to the AmCare/first aid station at the front of the warehouse, stating that he didn't feel well, and he asked for an ambulance. The HR rep and the AmCare went ahead and told him just to go back to work. So he did. He was not feeling any better, so he went back to the AmCare first aid station and again told them that he was not feeling well. He thought he needed to go to the hospital. They told him a second time, just go back to work, you'll be fine. Well, he went back to the ship dock to collapse on the warehouse floor and needed to be wheeled out on a wheelchair. They finally did get him, and when he got to the hospital, he found out that he had had a stroke. And that's not unusual for the AmCare and first aid reps to just either send people back to work and ignore their complaints, or worse, send them home on unpaid time, which is what we call UPT. Basically just being sent home and not getting paid for the rest of the day. Amazon does not want to call for an ambulance because they don't want the cost of it. They do not want any work comp cases for their safety records, and it also increases their premium for the work comp policies through Sedgwick Insurance. And when I found out that this is happening, some of the coworkers had told me what they had seen and heard. I went ahead and wrote a note on our Voices of Amazon bulletin board, pointing it out. The bulletin board is what all the workers read at break time on their phones. And I also went into the HR office and complained as to why they didn't just take this person to the hospital and call an ambulance. Why would they send somebody to work, especially an older veteran employee who's been there multiple years? It would definitely not be like to just make any of this up. But unfortunately, actually, a few weeks later, they did bring in additional fans to the warehouse, and that did help a little bit. Just a few weeks after that happened, with our coworker having a stroke, we had another coworker on the ship dock that, again, to AmCare first aid, stating that he did not feel well at all. He said that he told me that he felt that his heart was beating out of his chest and that he thought he was having a heart attack. the AmCare and safety rep people went ahead and told him to just go home, take unpaid time. Begged and pleaded for an ambulance, telling him again that he thought he was going to have a heart attack if he wasn't already having one now. And they eventually called an ambulance. As soon as he got to the hospital, they landed up by a shot of medication to actually stop his heart because it was beating over 400 times per minute. And after 90 seconds, they went ahead and had to give him another shot to get his heart started. And then they landed up doing emergency surgery leg and landed up putting a stent inside of his heart to actually open up one of the ventricles so that he could live. And again, when word of that got back to me, again, I raised hell, another note on the VOA board. I stormed into the HR office again, demanded why people who are coming with serious complaints and serious health issues after that heat, why are they being sent back to work and why are they being denied an ambulance? And then I asked some specialist / liaison person that used to work there just to be told that that one position for 8,000 employees at the JFK 8 building exists because it's a budget cut. And what people need to understand is that our current director, Ray, is actually the former assistant general manager from Bessemer, who year and the year before on the unionizing there in Bessemer, Alabama, by firing a lot of people. And his reward was that last August, he got promoted to be the general manager at the JFK 8 building in Staten Island. As soon as he came in last August, he immediately started firing workers and organizers. If you were caught wearing an ALU t-shirt, or if you were caught having a conversation about a union, you were immediately dismissed. And he was telling the managers and the assistants and the supervisors to just begin writing people up for no apparent reason. If we had a small amount of mail coming in the morning, he would use that as an excuse to write people up for low productivity, or he would bounce people from station to station, meaning that we would get logged off each time we would have to begin at another area. That would decrease our numbers and be another reason to be written up or to be terminated. If you went to the bathroom, if you got something to drink, every single thing was against us, even worse than before, in order for people to be terminated. And I was going on that VOA board constantly and constantly going into the HR office. And also telling my coworkers to, you have to look out for each other. We have to work, we have to literally help each other through this, through the workday, because we cannot rely on management to do the right thing. And I file an OSHA complaint, number one, because we no longer have a work comp specialist or liaison that has concerns and questions from injured workers. And two, we also had another issue where another one of these budget cuts from the new Ray Roach. He is now telling us that we're only allowed to have one pair of gloves per week. So the workers on a typical day will go through 3, 4, 5 pairs of gloves, depending on what area in the warehouse they're working, because these gloves are very thin and they're very cheap, and they get told we're literally handling thousands of packages every single day. These packages and boxes go from conveyor belt to conveyor belt to department. Sometimes they drop on the floor. Sometimes we have broken books coming out of those packages and boxes that we have to handle. Other times we have breaking, materials, fluids coming out, soy chub, barbecue sauce, anything that is in liquid form. If a package breaks, all that stuff gets all over our packages. Not to mention people are still getting COVID. So people are sneezing and coughing in the warehouse because all the new hires having their vaccination cards even checked, and they're not even being told about COVID as far as mask. So we also have workers coughing and sneezing all over these packages and boxes, and first stays on those packages for us. And that's something that the customers, if a customer receives an Amazon pack, they better wipe alcohol or use protect before they open up that pack. And then just when we didn't think anything could get worse, I landed up reporting a couple of weeks back for me in the break room. This guy wouldn't leave me alone. He kept to start fights with me and was in the break room, cursing, screaming, causing a lot of scene. And I kept telling him to stay away from me, and he wouldn't. So I went to him, and the person had also mentioned that he wanted to shoot one of our female supervisors and said that he had a gun at home and was going to bring it into JFK 8 to handle the situation because he was upset that he had complained about her and wasn't automatically terminated. So my report involved the harassment and the threat that he had made against us. And this guy who was already moved to a different floor, because we have four floors in the warehouse at JFK 8. This guy came downstairs from the second or third floor, came into the break room where he knows I'm at, and basically body checked me from behind. He slammed into me while I had my back turned when I was trying to badge out for the morning break. That happened on August 21st. So I got hit really hard from behind and got knocked forward almost into the wall. And when I turned around, this guy was screaming and cursing at me, saying that he did it on purpose because I had reported him and he was upset about that. I went ahead and there's cameras everywhere. All over Amazon. I knew that if I had laid one hand on him, if I had defended myself physically, I would have been automatically terminated because there's allegedly a zero tolerance policy for workplace violence. Amazon. And in the past, anybody who threw a punch, whether they were defending themselves or not, was automatically terminated on. Well, in this particular case, I went up to the 8th and where security. I reported this guy. He had followed me there after the assault and was still screaming and cursing at me. I told the staff to call the police and that I wanted to report an assault. They refused to call the police. Instead, they went ahead and just got in between us. They ended up taking me into a back room at the HR office and having me fill out a report on a piece of paper, which I don't trust because there are shredder machines all over the HR office. So that's where all these paper reports wind up. So I went ahead and called the police while I was writing my report. And they asked if this guy, I said he claimed that he did the week before, but he took a backpack, not a clear one, which by policy we're supposed to be using clear backpacks to come in and out of the building. So anyway, the police landed up sending 8 cops immediately. They were there within 2 minutes of my phone call. And at that, they came into the 8th office. I explained to them what had happened. Director Ray Roach was right there inside the HR room. He came out of his office and told the loss prevention rep, who the footage for any stolen items, to not share the video with the assault. So the loss prevention rep came over to me and was shaking and was apologizing left and right telling the cops that he allowed to show the camera footage of the assault that had just happened. And the police were really upset, saying, we have to write a report, we have to see who the witnesses are, we have to know what happened so that we know what the appropriate charges are going to be. You've shown us the tape, why aren't you showing us? The loss prevention guy continued to say that he wasn't, that as the director, Ray Roach, snuck out the back of the HR office. Now, you think as a director, if you're in charge of the building, cops in your HR office right in front of you, you would think that would be mildly curious about what had happened and would want to cooperate fully with parties. But that's in this case. So I landed up having to go outside because the person who assaulted me had run into the parking lot and was trying to get from the police. So they took me outside, put me in a cop car, that I could, we could roam around the parking lot looking for him and that I could identify him. And when I did identify him, he was sitting at one of the break tables outside of the JFK. Some of the cops were around him, and there was a woman nearby who seemed to be consoling him. Thought this guy's mother works there and is possibly either a manager or a supervisor. He came down to get in between him and the cops, and the cops that her son was special and therefore to allow him to be arrested for assaulting me. And then the cops had to go back and forth about whether or not this was going to be a psych. The mother then insisted that an ambulance be called on the guy who attacked me because he was upset that he was about to be arrested. And it happened, I realized, okay, this, for her to jump in and take action that quickly and do what to say to get sympathy for her son, this guy's probably done this before. And he's probably going to do it again. Well, what happened after that is that they put him on paid suspension for a week, which in my mind, I was taking the paid, being in video games, doing whatever, not having to come into work and still getting a paycheck. And from HR, ever went to that supervisor on the ship dock and said, hey, this guy threatened to shoot you. Nobody ever told her. She had to hear it from me on the day that I was assaulted because she came up to me and
asked me what happened. We lost Howard too.
No, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can. Yeah, so apparently, on Friday, an HR rep came to me and said that the investigation was closed, and they refused to tell me or that he had threatened whether or not this guy was still an employee and was still, in fact, in the building now, still. So that told me that they did not fire him. His mother must have some pretty good connections there. But again, it was another situation where I had to call the EEOC and tell them what had just happened. I contacted OSHA again to let them know that the director had interfered with the police investigation regarding an assault. And it's been a big mess. To say the least, I mean, the behavior toward employees at Amazon is really atrocious. A lot of the young female workers have to deal with sexual harassment. The female workers get treated like workhorses and are bullied and intimidated. And this is why a lot of the guys, especially the young guys at Amazon, standing around just either social or playing on their phones. And the way the women are treated there is really.
Hey, come on, I'm on it.
In April of. And that's that on that particular day, I had a male supervisor physically push me back from going to the bathroom and not use the ladies' room. So it's those kind of things that they happen all the time. And because I have a work comp background, 20 years in California before we were in the recession, I jump on these issues and I don't let go until something is done. She needs to be resolved. It needs to be addressed and it needs to be resolved. And so I will write notes. I will take documentation. I'll keep witness statements, write down where I was, what the time was, what the day was, what section of the warehouse I was in. I have no problem contacting OSHA or the EEOC or the board. In fact, I never board to let them know what had happened with the assault and the threat against the other supervisor and additional charges for and discrimination are being filed against that director, Ray Roach. I already have a handful of charges against him past year. But this kind of nonsense goes on all the time, unfortunately. And it's a shame. It shouldn't have to be that way. You would think when you place, you should be able to feel safe and just do your job, and especially when the job is physical and you're working 10 to 12 hour days, working as hard as you can, as fast, doing an extreme amount of heavy lifting and cardio and working through strains and sprains and all the other drama going on. It's really a $1 trillion company is so incredibly awful to their employees because it's all about profit. So that's where we're at right now. Pez is exactly the opposite of what Amazon does and exactly what actually happens inside these warehouses.
So, Natalie, if you could take a few minutes and bring people up to date on where the union is at. I know that, you know, there's a lawsuit to remove the current leadership and have elections. Sounds like you've been doing this without formal union support. So where are we at there?
What's been happening the last few months is that many of the organizers actually left last year in December from the Amazon Labor Union because Chris Smalls was repeatedly Constitution to give himself 100% power of the decision making and the money as far as the donations go. And many of the organizers just felt that Chris more like a dictator instead of a union leader, and trying to reason with him over an extended amount of time prior to that was not fruitful. They went ahead and formed what they now call the Reform ALU Caucus. Twitter pages, Instagram, they really need everybody's support. Well, they went ahead and used for to take Chris to court a couple of months ago was, number one, they're fighting for fair and democratic elections for the Amazon Labor Union, because Chris Smalls and his buddies on the board have all been self-appointed by Chris and hires and fires people without anybody. And so the fighting for funds was the number one priority. But also in the lawsuit, they had up to more than 8% organizers in the caucus that were willing to testify again, because Chris has been using strong arm tactics and intimidation. And he, in fact, assaulted one of our ALU organizers last year at the Labor Notes Conference. And he also, him and his VP, Derek Palmer, together they beat up an Amazon worker last December, and both of the victims were actually caught on. And dozens of people have been complaining about being in Chris through text message, through in-person visits when Chris the property, and to our main people come in and out of at the end of the day. He loves to intimidate people and scream at people, women, which he normally did people, but he's still doing it now. And this is in between all of his traveling and partying, because ever since the union election was victorious last April, he has literally been traveling and partying and getting high with his friends all over the world and blowing through millions of dollars donation money without any receipt, without any accounting whatsoever. And that's really a disservice to our donors who have been incredibly supportive ever since 2020 when this first happened. So right now the Reform Caucus is trying to clean all of this up, which they're democratic, but that the workers can decide how of labor reps over the voting. We're trying to get a fairly elected ALU on contract, because that's really where the focus should be. It's partying for the past month. He should have stayed in Staten Island to continue to build strength and build numbers in the organization and build support and sit down and work on a contract. We had Bill Fletcher get involved trying to mediate the situation between the ALU and the Reform. Chris went ahead and pulled out of those out of that mediation meeting at the last minute. Had Jane McAlevey come in and give some really sense to Chris about the organization and what he needed to do to work on the contract. And instead, he ignored her advice and continued traveling. I mean, that's all he wants to do. And the TW, the Congress of Essential Workers that Chris started in 2020, those workers already came forward and talked with the ALU organizers about how these type of problems have been ongoing since 2020. When I first became an ALU organizer in April of 2021, I had gone down already to the OEW crew. So unfortunately, Chris is really obsessed with fame and fortune and seems to think that he has the right advisors. And it's really a shame that it's gotten this bad, because a lot of the organizers really went into it with genuine intentions. And we're still in the JFK field. If any worker needs help for any reason at all, we step up and we help. When we had the fires and the Canadians and it was filling up New York, it was the Reform organizers that literally went to Home Depots and Lowe's and bombed thousands of masks, N95 masks, to bring into work, because we weren't getting any masks from management. And we were all getting oxide poisoning from all the smoke fumes. A lot of people got really sick. And whenever anybody is discriminated against or has a work comp injury, I step up daily basis to help those workers to file claims, to document it, to speak with HR people, helping to get them lawyers, work comp lawyers outside of work. We're still active. We're still taking care of our own, because we gave up on management ever coming around to do the right thing. We gave up on politicians ever stepping out at all. The one thing that the politicians did do, Ramos in Queens, she piggybacked on a law that came through in January of 2022 in California called the Workers Warehouse Protection Act for workers in California. Jessica Ramos recently passed that and created a similar law that the governor just signed, I think, last December. So it basically deals with quotas and says be reasonable and the workers have to, they need to produce safely, because the faster you work, the more injuries happen. But outside of that workers, it seems to me that a lot of these politicians are interested in just doing photo ops with Chris than they are about actually helping the workers. So in the meantime, me and all the other organizers in the caucus are still doing whatever we can to help the workers. And we actually did not get a decision from the judge because she keeps throwing it back at the caucus, trying to get us to work something out with Chris, even though we all know Chris well enough to know that he's not going to compromise in any way, shape, or form. It's either his way, okay? He's either 100% charge and answers to nobody, and that's it. So it's going to be up to the Reform Caucus to file court dates, continue to push for public support for fair. I'm on social media with people overseas because cities are still booking him left and right for different worker summits and paying him to be and paying for his buddies to come along with him and party while the 8 are still suffering and still need help.
Yeah, I've seen him at some conferences. Somebody I know was asked to mediate, or, you know, between the Reform Caucus and Chris Smalls. His name's Bill Fletcher, and he said Smalls backed out. So I think you're right. You can't trust this guy. Last time you were here, you said you were hoping the Teamsters would come in. Have they played any role in supporting you, or any interest, showed any interest in supporting you?
You know, me and a few of the other organizers in touch with people from the Teamsters for a Democratic organization, they have been supportive, and the Teamsters did ask Chris if the ALU wanted to join forces with them before and after the election, and without taking a vote, without Chris listening to anybody else's opinion, he went ahead and told the Teamsters no, which is what the workers inside the JFK building actually want. Many people, especially the older workers, have come up to me saying, we're not going to have a chance in hell of unionizing the right way unless we form with a national union. And a lot of them have family members and friends that are either in the Teamsters or used to be in the Teamsters. And I think a lot of the workers would love to join forces with the Teamsters. We also have the RWDSU and the AFL-CIO coming around the union election. A lot of their reps were coming around trying to join with the ALU. And the few times that I spoke with Chris about it, trying to get his opinion and trying to find he wouldn't do the right thing by us and join forces with the national union, his response was that nobody was going to mess with his money. He wasn't going to share any of the donations with any. It was all about the money. And as far as he was concerned, those donations were his money, not the union's money. And I made it very clear to Chris that he basically on us for money. And that's horrible. But if we could get a brand new board that was serious about a contract, I can guarantee you that they would be willing to join forces or any other national union that was serious about the workers and not just propping up.
Did you stop speaking or did we lose your connection?
Just stop speaking because that's
okay.
That's where we're at right now.
Okay. Bill, do you have anything you'd like Natalie to address?
No, I can only say what I said earlier, that people like Natalie are unbelievably courageous and determined. And I have such admiration for her and for her coworkers for doing this, because they are the future. And organizing at places like Amazon, Walmart, Home Depot, these large chains spread out all over, and big chains and big stores. One of the challenges of a Starbucks is you're talking 15, 18 people maybe in a store, and there are thousands of them. You've got 4,000 or 5,000 people in an Amazon warehouse. There are two of them here in Baltimore, and no campaigns going on at all. So the courage that these people show, and that Natalie particularly shows, personally and organization, is just extraordinary. And I'm just glad to be on the program with her. And people should learn from her and learn what they're doing and see what they're going through, because they're setting a whole new future for the workers' movement.
Yeah, I'll say amen to that. And Natalie, we need to figure out what the technical problem is, because I'd like to have you back on and bring us up to date a little way down the road. These labor issues are so important, you know, not as Bill was pointing out earlier, when we had 37% union density, it wasn't just the 37% that were organized that benefited. It was whole sectors in those industries, because the employers had to compete with those standards. And or else, and this was in a time of fuller employment, people would go to the better places to work. So it's so important to rebuild the labor movement, because right now, the two-party system, the Democrats take labor for granted. Labor has already endorsed Biden. He didn't have to give him a damn thing. And we're not going to get a damn thing. So I really appreciate, you speaking, Natalie, despite the technological problems. And we definitely should have you back. And Bill, also, thank you for coming on. And I think,
great.
You filled in when Natalie was having trouble getting on.
Yeah.
So we've been going for about 1 hour and 10 minutes. It's a little longer than we usually go. So we'll be back to this subject, because it's just so important. I just want to wrap up by reminding people, if those of you that didn't come on at the beginning, I've been involved in organizing a speakers tour for some Ukrainian and Russian anti-war socialists. We spoke in Chicago last Sunday and Tuesday. I was out there, and those events went very well. Driving back from Chicago, I ran into this tractor trailer, and the trailer, on the back of the trailer, there was F middle finger UCK or F middle finger CK Russian government on one panel, and pray for Ukraine on the other, with a map of Ukraine and the yellow and blue flag colors, which made my day for that long drive back. And I looked at the guy's cab. He's probably an independent operator, trucker working on his own, and it's his trailer. So I gave him a honk and a thumbs up. But anyway, that was good to see. So we'll put in the chat again, or I guess we just did, the link to the live stream tonight. They're speaking 7 Eastern time. Anna Perikota and Denis Bondar from Ukraine, and Ilya Budreskis from Russia. And Ilya is now exiled. And these people are really sharp. I told them that they're an inspiration to me, because the left in Eastern Europe is much more sophisticated and internationally aware than the left in the United States. So I really recommend you doing that. And also in the chat, we have 3 interviews that came out Thursday. One was in The Nation, one was in Democracy Now, and one with Troy, New York Independent Media. So those are worth reading. Particularly The Nation one is very succinct and to the point. So I recommend people take a look at those as well. And next week, I don't have a guest scheduled, so we'll do question and answers, but I got a number of people that I've met out at the Socialism 2023 conference to talk about a variety of issues, from what is socialism to international situation, pro-democracy activists from Hong Kong and Taiwan. So they'll be scheduled. I also have a Green candidate who wants to come on this fall elections, and some others. So, you know, we'll announce those when they're ready. And meanwhile, everybody have a safe week, and we'll see you next week.